Welcome to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello everybody and welcome to the show. Made possible by our friends at Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. It's Julian DeStoop sitting in for Sam Edmund. Today we're joined by a man who, by his own admission, was a public failure, but who then became a far more private success. Fergus Watts was twice a first-round draft pick, who played only six AFL games at two clubs. That didn't stop him going on to create Australia's largest independent marketing organisation. He's now pouring his energy into a foundation he got so much from as a teenager, the not-for-profit Reach Foundation, as their new CEO. Fergus, welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Julian, thank you. Good to be here.
Great to have you here today, because I imagine life is pretty busy on the home front and the work front as well.
It is. It's about to get busier. My wife's expecting our third child, under 3.5, so it's all about to heat up.
Now, a public failure, that seems a bit tough on yourself.
Yeah, well, I think it's the truth. I think if you're a first-round draft pick, which I was, pick 14 to the Crows, promised the world, you know, thought I was going to have a 15-year career at centre-half forward, and then came back to the Saints and, traded for another first-round pick at that point, and then broke my leg in round two and didn't play again. So, you know, as far as my football went, it was... you know, was a failure, my career.
We'll delve back into the footy very shortly, but just right here and right now, only 36 years of age, you've packed a lot in already. We'll chat about Bastion, but right now, what's on your plate from a work perspective?
So I'm the CEO of the Reach Foundation, and I'm the chairman of Bastion. So they're kind of the two things. CEO of Reach is my full-time job, and Reach is a youth organisation founded by Jim Steins. And it's all about preventative mental health. So teaching young people emotional and resilient skills and to be able to sort of conquer life, basically. And that's what Reach has done for 30 years. It's pioneered the work. It is the most influential youth organisation in the country. It's an honour to be able to continue that work.
So how do you split your time with Bastion and Reach? I mean, how's the sort of breakdown there?
It's 90% Reach, 10% Bastion, probably. Yep. But it's a bit of a broad answer because I suppose it's no different to, you know, Bassett, who's the CEO of Seek and is also the chairman of St Kilda. Yep. You know, like there is a crossover on that sort of stuff. But as I've always said, I think the only way to live life is all inclusive. You know, so the whole work life balance thing that everyone goes on about. I just don't think it makes any sense. It's your work and your life, it all combines into one. So being the chairman, the non-executive chairman of Bastion is more of an oversight position and making sure we're overseeing the organisation, the governance of the organisation and those sort of things, where my job at Reach is to really drive it and maximise the impact that we're having on young people in the community.
And there's enough going on the home front as well.
My word, there is. Yes, 3 kids under 3.5 any day now. And it'll all get very hectic.
So it's been a great journey, but we need to go back to the start. So 1985, you're born in London, mm-hmm. and as a four-year-old, you moved to Australia. Why the move from the family to Australia?
My parents had a business. It was a recruitment business at the time, and then my old man tells the story that the only market that was going well was international recruitment is what they did. So they had an international business. And everything was really struggling except the Australian business, basically. So we moved over here in 1989 and never looked back.
What are your earliest memories of living in Australia?
I have this very distinct memory of my mother to go to a birthday party in London. Kids used to dress up in bow ties and suspenders and, you know, all that sort of stuff to go to a birthday party. And I remember going to a birthday party at the Sandringham Indoor Sports Centre playing indoor cricket and volleyball and kids wearing Mambo t-shirts and that sort of stuff and mum dressing me up in the bow tie and the suspenders and it was a disaster for a young fella. And I remember at the time thinking, that's it, I'm Australian now, not English, and
You know, it's time to move forward.
That's not a great...
Oh, mate, it wasn't a good...
That's not a great introduction.
No.
And Aussie Rules Football, I'm assuming as a four-year-old, you're living in Melbourne, it's just straight away, you remember footy, your mates playing footy, getting involved in footy?
Yes, but interestingly enough, I went through the... I think it was VicKick back then. And I went to a VicKick program and I said to my old man, I'm never playing football again. And he tells a funny story about me going along and just being totally disengaged with footy. But then once I got into, I played at East Sandringham Junior Footy Club, and I think they might have forged the birth date on that and got me in a little bit earlier so I could go play football there. But once I got into the under-9s program at East Sandy, I mean, I never looked back. Footy was my whole life.
The Saints? It was that you followed the Saints early?
Did, yeah, what, yeah, yeah.
Many days at Moorabbin, or was that a bit before your time?
No, I remember distinctly plenty of days at Moorabbin, and we always used to take the mickey out of my brother because, you know, I was glued to the footy start to finish, and my brother would turn up, he'd eat his pie, he'd eat his chocolate bar, and he'd go to sleep under the seats.
Younger brother.
Yeah. And that was, so we had a lot of fond memories at Moorabbin, and then, you know, my old man, under Rod Butter's reign as the president, joined the board, and then was a CEO for a couple of year-long sort of caretaker stints as part of that. So, you know, grew up with St Kilda, really in our family.
Heroes as a kid, who'd you love watching?
Oh, it was very hard to go past Stuart Lowe, you know.
Big buckets.
It's very hard to go past Lowey. But I think I was somewhat unique as a young guy because I would go to the football and I would watch forward patterns. You know, I'd watch.
What age are we talking about here?
Like 10, you know.
You are out of your
15, you know. And I would, like, the ball would be up the other end and, you know, someone would take a big hanger or something would happen and they'd go, "Did you see that?" And I would say, "No, I'm watching the other end." You know, and that was always what really fascinated me about football was the patterns, the strategic, all the movement. And I used to go to the game and sort of watch the whole thing. And I was never a massive fan, you know. I was never a massive supporter, and now I'm definitely not, but passionate about the game.
Where'd that come from?
It's hard to say. I think it's just the way I'm wired, to be honest. Like, I'm just much more interested in why something works, how it works, rather than necessarily what it does.
You touched on your junior footy club there. Just take us through your junior career. And at what stage did it start to get serious and you thought, oh, I'd like to do this at the very elite level?
Yeah, well, I think I went through the stage that a lot of young people do is, you know, during winter I wanted to be a professional footballer and during summer I wanted to be a professional cricketer. And that was it. And I remember there being... Remember when I was sort of 15, 16, always wanting to be a professional footballer, but, you know, so does everyone. And I remember going for a run with my old man and blowing up on the run. And he said to me, "This is the age where you got to be fit. You know, you've actually got to train. You can't just naturally you're not just naturally can run around." And he said, "You know, if you want to play footy, you got to train. You know, like, that's the way it works." So I remember a couple of periods like that or sort of defining moments where I thought, I've really got to think about this. And then when I finished my under 17th year, I got some feedback from recruiters and from other people in football saying, you know, you can catch it and you can kick it and you can play the game. There's no question about that, but you're way too slow and you're never going to get drafted. And so the next day, I remember we played, I think it was Gippsland, we played in our last game for the Sandy Dragons in the under 17th year. And then the very next day I started sprint training down at Dendy Park in Brighton, pulling sleds and training with other, you know, stall gift sprinters and those sort of things. And basically trained every day until that point to improve my agility and my speed. And not that I was ever that quick. In fact, I was probably very slow, but certainly improved myself a lot along that journey. So, you know, it really started at the end of that 17th year.
Yeah, so and obviously you got your second year tack up after that. You know, you're 197, you're 90 kilos, key forward, big prospect. How was that second year for you and what sort of, you know, sort of conversations were you having with footy clubs about being drafted?
Yeah, well, my top age year was great, you know. And I did everything right, you know, like everything. Trained, was always doing extras, was eating right, was, you know, all that sort of stuff. All my mates in year 12 were going out and drinking and all. I didn't drink a drop when I was in year 12. Like, I really committed to the process. And then played school footy at Wesley College, so I played the 10 APS games through that, played through the Sandy Dragons, and then, you know, played the Vic Metro Carnival and you know, played well, won the Vic Metro Best and Fairest. I was all Australian under 18 that year. And then sort of from there, I suppose it was a matter of where I was getting drafted, not if.
And you touched on your dad before, Jim, becoming, you know, CEO at St Kilda and working high up at the Saints. What age were you then when he did that?
He had two cracks at it. The first time I must have been 15, maybe. And then the second time was when I was at the Crows.
Yeah.
And there was some crossover when I came back to the Saints. Yeah.
First time, was there any issues for you? Did it, having your dad involved and you're trying to make your way through, was there any issues there? Or
No, not the first time. When I was 15. If anything, it was beneficial because, you know, he could team me up with a couple of different recruiters to get some insight or get some feedback or, you know, all those sort of things. We had Xavier Clark come and live with us when he got drafted over from the NT, and he billeted with us for a few months. And, you know, so that was great to get to experience that. So it was beneficial in that first one. The second time, getting traded back to a club where your old man's a CEO, that's got a few complications to it and a few hairs on it. But, you know, sort of we worked through that and it was what it was.
Yeah, because you got Ned Reeves at the moment playing for Hawthorn, and his dad's the CEO. Can you sort of relate to that?
Yeah, I can, certainly. I didn't think it would be a big deal. I mean, when it happened, I remember speaking to Grant Thomas through the trade period and also my manager. And it was like, I can't go to the Saints. Like, my old man's at the Saints. Like, it's a bit ridiculous. And I remember Tomo and a couple others saying, nah, it's like, you know, and my old man saying, it's irrelevant. It's got nothing to do with me. I'm totally removed from the system. Like, you know, they pick whoever they pick is on its merits. It's got nothing to do with me. So I thought, yeah, okay, well, that's no big deal and that'll be fine. And it's not. You know, it wasn't a big deal, right? And so... reality is if I hadn't have either got injured or, you know, went on and had a long career, you know, it would have been a completely irrelevant little blip, you know. But the reality is I didn't do that, and I was at a club and my old man was a CEO. So people will think about that, whatever they think about it. And to be honest, it's more of an external ego position than it is anything that is actually drenched in reality.
We'll touch on that after the break. You're listening to This Is Your Journey, thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. So despite enormous promise, Fergus Watts' AFL career is about to pass by in a flash as injuries and setbacks lurk around every other corner. Next, that door slams shut, but another opens.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, great to have your company on This Is Your Journey, made possible by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. We're chatting to former footballer turned highly successful businessman Fergus Watts. Fergus, pick 14, 2003 National Draft. You're taken by the Adelaide Crows. Did you have any inkling that you might be heading into state?
I did a little bit. I thought there was a chance I was going to get out to Geelong or to Essendon in some of those earlier picks. And, God, it was a while ago now, but I think there was one particular pick. I can't remember if it was Kane Tanase or Kepler Bradley or someone went where they weren't meant to go. Mm-hmm. And then that sort of threw the rest of that sort of first round a little bit. It put everyone out of position. I think Kepler being the main other big guy in that draft, and he went out to Essendon.
Essendon, yep. Pick six, I reckon.
Yeah. And so that sort of flipped that a little bit. And then once that happened, I remember thinking, yeah, well, Adelaide is a likely outcome. And Port Adelaide had pick 15. And I thought that might have been a chance as well.
What are your memories of draft night?
I remember all my mates going to schoolies and me packing my bags. That's what I remember. I remember having a bit of a get together at my place afterwards, and none of my mates being there because they'd all left to go to Byron Bay, and a few of our guys from the old footy club and some of those sort of things like our parents' age were there, and I was getting on a flight at 8 or 9 a.m. the next morning to go to Adelaide, you know, so I was packing my bag and saying goodbye to my girlfriend, and that was it.
So round 17, 2004, you make your debut against the Western Bulldogs. You're 7 touches. you kick a goal. Scotty Welsh kicks 7. You win by 5 goals. Everyone seems to remember fondly their first game.
Yeah.
What are your memories?
I remember, I don't know if I've ever spoken about this, I remember walking out from the huddle. I think I started on a half-forward flank maybe or something like that. I remember walking out from the huddle. It's Nigel Smart's last game. Packed house. Noise was incredible. And I remember nearly crying.
Yeah.
And I remember feeling this sort of overwhelming emotion as I walked out and had that moment where I was like, this is it. I've wanted to play an AFL game my whole life and I'm about to do it, you know. So I distinctly remember that. And then, I remember that being great. I remember a particular moment where Smarty kicked the ball in from 50 and I marked it in the goal square and kicked a goal. And, to be Nigel Smart, the legend's last game of footy, and then having that moment with him was really nice.
And you had a decent day at the SANFL one day. 10 goals in a final.
Yeah, that
you must have been feeling it that day.
That happens as well. You know, I flew the day before. I flew to Perth to be the emergency. The Crows were playing the Eagles in the first final, second final.
Yeah, yep.
And I went over there and sort of did the warm up, and then no one was injured, and then I packed my bags and got back on the plane and flew the red eye home. And got home late, you know, whatever time that lands, midnight or something like that, the night before, and then went to to Footy Park and played that game, and yeah, had a good day.
So 2 years at the Crows, and then you traded for pick 17 to the Saints, where your dad is, as we mentioned before. So just take us. When did you think there might be a move from the Crows? Were you keen to get out of the Crows and get back? How did it all sort of unfold?
So I was. It went up and down in that last year. So I was 23rd man a lot. For weeks and weeks and weeks in a row, I was playing well in the SANFL. Crows were playing really well. Crows were on top of the ladder. And the honest answer is, looking back now as a 36-year-old and an 18-year-old kid, I was just petulant, you know. I was just wanting more, complaining about not getting picked, grass is greener on the other side, all that sort of stuff. And there was a couple of moments there throughout the year where I was like, no, I'm going to stay at the Crows and I'll sign a new deal and that, you know, I want to commit to that. And then there were other times when, you know, I remember a couple of times where it was like, well, if, you know, this person gets injured or that person gets injured, then you'll play, you know, and that person did get injured and then they pick someone else, you know, and stuff like that, which happens every week in footy. But me really sort of cracking the sads about that a bit and then having that from a football perspective and then also trying to get settled in a new city. Reality is I struggled with that.
Yeah.
And I struggled with that for a number of reasons. And the lure of being able to play back in Victoria was too strong. And so I'd had a couple of conversations with the Saints, with Tomo, Grant Thomas, who was the coach at the time, had a couple of conversations with him and he was saying, you know, we got Rewald, Kaczynski, Gehrig, we want to play four bigs, we want to push Rui up the ground more, Cozzy can play in the ruck, you know, we need another K forward, we want it to be you. So I was having those conversations and I thought, well, if I've got just as many opportunities back in Melbourne from an AFL perspective and I can live in Melbourne, then that's a good decision, you know. So I did that and, you know, there's a whole bunch of other realities around that I wasn't really aware of at the time. But that's sort of how it came about.
So you make your Saints debut round one 2006 against the Eagles, Subiaco. They've come off just losing a granny, so amazingly strong side. 5 touches, dropped to the VFL the next week. 2 weeks later, you break your ankle.
The next week. Yeah. So I was playing all right. Like, I remember kicking 5 in the practice game against Sydney, I think the week before that game at Subi. I was in good nick. I was feeling good. I was playing good. And then played that game at Subi and, you know, didn't blow the lights out, but, you know, felt kind of okay, like I was finding my feet. And then, got dropped and the reason at that point was matchups, you know, we'd just drop a big bloke, bring in a small bloke, blah, blah, blah. And then,
yeah, was playing out at Port Melbourne in the VFL that week. I kicked, I can't remember, but it was, you know, two or three or four in the first half, and was playing good, feeling great, and then, yeah, twisted and broke my leg, and that was basically it.
And was it a straightforward break, or was it?
No, it was a spiral fracture. So I'd ruptured my ankle the year before at the Crows, and because I was so close to playing every week, I didn't tell anyone. So I would strap my leg up. I'd steel tape and all this sort of stuff and strap my leg up by myself and not tell anyone that I was hurt until I got to a point where I couldn't really walk on it anymore, and I had to sort of fess up that I'd been playing with this injury for a couple of months. And then I came back to St Kilda, and obviously because of the stupidity of that, my left ankle was weak.
Yeah.
And so then came back and then I bent over to pick the ball, caught my foot in the ground and twisted. I got tackled at the time. And so it created a spiral fracture of my fibula, the outside bone. And then it was a dislocation and a full rupture. And I really, really got into it.
So then by the end of 2007, it's over. You delisted by the Saints. Early 20s, you know. Great junior career. You're thinking you have a long AFL career, and then it's done.
Well, that's right. I think I had something like 12 operations in the 18 months that followed on my ankle. Whether that be clean outs or restructural stuff or whatever it was, ankle just never got right. I was trying to rush it back, couldn't quite get it done, and it just never came good. To this day, it's no good. And then I had the great joy of breaking my jaw in the last game. I played at Casey and then walked into the coach's room on crutches with a big swollen face and got the sack.
God, that's not glamorous.
It wasn't ideal, no.
So how was that mentally to deal with at the time? And then I guess in hindsight, how much did you learn about yourself in that period?
I learned an enormous amount, you know, and your point at the start about my career being a failure, it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. Because in business, you fail all the time. And as an entrepreneur, you fail all the time. But most of the time, my experience of people I come across in business, they're so scared of failing. So they strategize for months and months and months trying to get this perfect outcome. And they write hordes of documents and all these sort of things that come out. Just so they can get it perfect. And the reality is, it's never perfect, you know? And so through the experience I had in footy, it's okay to fail, you know? You failed quite publicly, you know? And to a point where, you know, like I used to get abused walking down the street, and even when I finished football, for years afterwards, I would get, you know, especially if I went to Adelaide.
Not forgiving over there.
I got plenty of grief And, you know, I remember walking to a spud bar in Caulfield one time and, you know, a guy stopping his car, rolling down the window and just hurling abuse at me. Like, so you fail on a public stage. A failure in business then, I mean, is such a minute thing. So it was the best thing that happened to me because it really taught me that it's okay to fail. It's okay to have these vulnerable moments emotionally. It's okay to deal with all these sort of things as long as you get up again and you try quickly, you know, and you learn fast. And that's what my life's been about ever since.
So you're embarking on a footy career though at the time that you thought was going to last a lot longer than it did. You're not at uni at the time.
No.
You haven't got a degree at the time.
No. Nope.
Was there an element of, what the hell am I going to do now?
Oh, my word, yes. I'd no clue. I mean, I came out of footy. I mean, I don't even know if I had an email address, you know. Like, I didn't have a clue what to do. And I met with... I got some advice. The best way to do this is just go meet with a bunch of people, right? And learn what they do and understand what an accountant does and a lawyer does and a, you know, whatever. So I did that and I walked into an advertising agency and sort of just really liked the vibe of it, if nothing else. You know, they were wearing t-shirts and there was music playing and they weren't wearing suits and it was stuffy and you know, no one talking. And I just liked that vibe better. Anyway, long story short, I ended up getting offered a job at that advertising agency and accepted it. And that was sort of how I started my career.
We'll get stuck into that after the break. You're with This Is Your Journey, brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funeral. Celebrating lives, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Fergus's Bastia Group becomes a Bastian Collective and a global marketing advisory and communications juggernaut. Just how did that happen? We find out next.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, we hope you're enjoying this week's edition of This Is Your Journey. We're with former footballer and business pioneer Fergus Watt. So Fergus, the end of the business world, Bastion Group, as it was known, was founded in 2009. How did the idea come about? Was it on the back deck of your parents' place down in Rye on the Mornington Peninsula?
It probably had some forming of an idea on there for sure. Came about because I was working in an advertising agency that just got acquired and they'd merged with two businesses merged together. And the thing that I was fascinated about was the merging of the company, the kind of the way the corporate world worked from that perspective, and primarily how the individuals and the human beings within that system are sort of wrapped up in this corporate positioning, as opposed to emotional human beings as individuals with their own lives and their own responsibilities and everything else. And that was a thing that sort of fascinated me. And now, I was no expert at anything, but sort of got to that point and I thought, there's got to be something here where I can engage around the individual who is an expert at whatever the service is, and I can take away all the emotional worry that they've got, which is primarily around doing things that they're not good at, and just allowing them to be great. And that was kind of the premise of how it started. And so we went and got out, you know, left that business. The Reach Foundation were actually the very first client of Bastion 13 years ago, which is sort of serendipitous around, you know, full circle. But that was it. So I started a couple of individual businesses. We made our first acquisition and it's sort of grown from there.
So you're only 23 at the time. You sold your house. How big a risk was it to start this business?
Nah, not big at all,
okay,
to be honest. Yeah. It was one of the great, the best thing I possibly did was start a business at 23. Mm. No responsibility, no kids, no cost. I had no idea. And so, you know, I had like a little townhouse thing in Elwood. I sold that to be able to have enough dough to buy 30% of this PR company. And, I mean, if I'd have lost all that, I mean, it's not ideal, but it's not the end of the world. You know, I had no real responsibility at that time to anyone else other than me. And you know, I was a young fella. So, so it was great from that perspective. And the other great thing is that at 23, I thought I knew everything about everything and didn't. So I went into things with full bravado, whereas now it's totally different. I don't know if I could do it again now, to be honest, because you know all the things that can go wrong. You know the journey, you know how hard it is, you know all that sort of stuff. And you got a lot more responsibility. So, you know, I admire people that start businesses, you know, with a couple of kids on the ground and a mortgage, because then there really is a risk.
So 12 months in, there's a few hairy moments and you get your old man in.
Yes.
How big a help was he?
No, he was a great help because I was just going on instinct basically, right? I was going from deal to deal and it was all going fine. You know, I was paying the bills and I was doing, you know, whatever I was doing. And, but, you know, I remember one thing where I had two clients that paid me a combination of whatever the income was that I was generating from that, which was not much, $5,000-$7,000 a month. And I sort of mapped out my costs and my expenses. And I thought, I'm a 23-year-old kid. I'm trying to build a business. No one's going to take me seriously unless I drive a nice car. So I bought a BMW X5. And so I bought this X5 and I'd mapped out my kind of costs and it was the perfect to that $6,000 a month or whatever it was. And I remember driving it back and my old man going, geez, where did you get that car? And I explained the sort of strategy and he goes, you do understand though that that $6,000 is pre-tax. Mm-hmm. So you've got to pay tax and you don't get all the six, you know? And I said, no, I don't understand that. You know, so then I had to go get another client, you know, and those sort of things. So, you know, my old man's been my mentor in every sense of the word for forever. And so as a business, I mean, Dad's never sold a client, never delivered a piece of work, never any of that sort of stuff, but was the sort of the mentor and the guidance where I would do dumb stuff like that and I'd go back to him and say, where am I going wrong here? You know, what's happening? And he really played that role and has played that role, you know, for a long time.
So for those that aren't aware, what does Bastion do?
So we're a marketing company. So we do advertising, public relations, research. We make content. We do, you know, you watch the Alinta Energy advertising during the cricket. Like we do that advertising as an example. Rental car company that's launched in this country recently. We do all those advertisers, all that advertising. We do Xbox, that sort of stuff. So any sort of marketing initiative, we do. And we have a real cross-section of services that give you the full integrated sort of marketing mix.
So businesses all do things a little bit differently, but one thing you brought in was unlimited leave for staff that you brought in. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, we were very big. I got three rules when I run a business, and that is make each other's lives better. Number one, produce world-class work. It's better every time. Number two, and create and run good commercial businesses. Number three. They're the rules. And so you've got to make each other's lives better, right? And that's the gig. Now, making each other's lives better doesn't mean make each other's lives easier, especially in the agency world. Agency world is difficult. And so things like unlimited leave, and we had a full Bastion Academy, we still do. We got a full Bastion Academy with different education programs and emotional intelligence courses. And I actually brought a lot of the Reach work into Bastion, to develop people's emotional intelligence and resilience skills, around that, because that can, all of those initiatives, including unlimited leave, start to remove emotional angst from people's lives. So unlimited leave, you know, the obvious one is, oh, God, people are going to take 4 months off a year. Well, they're not, because you trust that they're there to do the job because they've got to produce world-class work. It's better every time and create and run good businesses. You can't do that if you're away for 4 months of the year, right? So when you come at it through that lens, the way people actually use unlimited leave is when their kid's got an athletics carnival at school and they want to go there and not take a day of leave, you know, or they want to, you know, take a long weekend or those couple of days in between the Easter break where you can probably get some time away. You know, you're not worried about your 4 weeks leave that are so, you know, so restrictive. And that removes a lot of this emotional angst. So you get a much better two-way connection with your staff and your people.
Off the back of that, I mean, footy's, there's a world of cliches, but one of them in business is you got to park your emotion, leave it at the door. I'm assuming from that last answer, that's probably not something you believe in.
Nah, it's complete rubbish, that, in my view. You have to acknowledge the emotion, and you have to acknowledge where emotion is good and where emotion is bad. And you know, that whole thing about leave the emotion at the door and all that sort of stuff, I've never seen that in business ever. I've seen people driven by their emotion, driven by their ego, driven by their, you know, the CV is the greatest ego developer of all time. You know, like emotion drives us in everything we do. It can't be removed, but it needs to be understood. And most of the time, I mean, the vast majority of the time, it's not understood because people haven't developed social and emotional resilience skills and a better understanding of who they are as a person. They haven't developed that as young people. And so when they get into adulthood, their emotions in many ways can rule their decisions. And I mean, that's the work we do at Reach, is trying to teach those skills. So they get in there and they can understand themselves better. So emotion's a really good thing. But I understand it, and I understand why that is allowing me to make the decision I'm making, and is that the right decision to make? You know, and that consciousness brings together something really special.
So I started as a small little business in Melbourne. So what sort of numbers are we employing now, Bastion? Whereabouts else in the world is there offices? And if you don't mind me asking, what sort of turnover are we talking about?
Yeah, so we got 300 odd staff. We've got offices in Melbourne, Sydney, Auckland, Los Angeles, and New York. We've got probably 200 of those staff in Australia, and then 50 in New Zealand, and roughly 50 in America. And sort of diversified our revenue streams and our service offerings across that. We don't talk publicly about our numbers, but it's somewhere between 50 and 100 million bucks in turnover. And yeah, we've seen, you know, we're the largest independent in the country now, and I'm pretty confident we're one of, if not the largest independents ever that's been created out of Australia in the marketing space, which is, you know, it's been there. Places full of amazing people doing great work.
So that's Bastion. After the break on This Is Your Journey with Fergus Watts, thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals celebrating lives, we'll get stuck into the Reach Foundation.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Been great to have your company here on This Is Your Journey. Thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Fergus Watts has been our guest today. Now, we mentioned off the top, Fergus, Reach Foundation, new CEO. Just explain why this foundation is so close to your heart.
Well, I've been involved in Reach for 21 years. Started as a 15-year-old that went along to a Heroes Day, which is a Reach product that we do, which is 500 young people in a room. Jim Steins was facilitating it along with Jules Lund. And you know, I fell in love with it. And for me, I was a private school educated kid that came from a, you know, good family and played footy. Like, that was my world, you know. And so to walk into something here and have real conversations about real things that existed in our life as a 15-year-old, it's pretty unique, you know, and it's still to this day is. But you know, Jim and Paul started it 28 years ago and 21 years ago when I worked in it. I mean, it was really unique. You didn't have these conversations. And so it's been a big part of my life ever since.
So what does it mean now to be the CEO? So you're on the board, you step away, become the CEO. What was sort of the idea behind that?
Well, a couple of years ago, I made the decision to step away from being the CEO of Bastion. I'm still the chairman. I'm still the non-executive chairman, so I'm still involved from that perspective. But I made the decision that my belief is that there's certain people for certain times, and my strength is building businesses. It's not running a 300-person business across three countries. And my brother, Jack, who's been involved, he started the sponsorship division within the company, and you know, he's sort of taken over bit by bit the whole show, and he's much better suited to run and be the CEO of a business like that. So about 18 months ago, 2 years, we made the decision. 18 months ago, I stepped out of that role, and Jack took it over, and then so probably for a year, I lived this great non-exec life, and you know, I had a few different businesses that I'm involved in and different things, which was great. But about 6 months ago, I thought it's a long life to be doing this, you know, and so I wanted to sink my teeth into something a bit deeper. Looked at a bunch of different opportunities, and couldn't really get overly excited about any of them, regardless of how sexy they might be, or there was some, you know, some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah,
and I just couldn't get juiced up about it. And then sort of this opportunity came up at Reach, and it just feels like the perfect job.
So, I mean, mental health and mental health amongst our youth is such a big problem. I can imagine it's only been exacerbated by the COVID situation we've been living through the last couple of years. So what is sort of some of your main motivations at Reach now that you're the CEO?
So the single most important thing that we can do at Reach, outside of impacting as many young people as we possibly can, is changing societal views on what is important in mental health. COVID didn't create a mental health crisis. It's showcasing a mental health crisis, right? And that is because in 2017, 5 years ago, of all health funding that were in this country, 1.3% of that went to preventative measures. Everything else, at 1.3% is $2 billion. Yeah. So the remaining $150 billion or whatever the number is, goes into intervention work. So from a mental health perspective, that means if a young person is having suicidal thoughts, is self-harming, is whatever, or that COVID has exacerbated, is just struggling. Just feels like the world is a big bad place, you know, is depressed. We as a society are really comfortable to throw billions and billions and billions of dollars at that point. But investing in the young person that doesn't is not perceived to have any obvious issues today, the answer is always money's better spent somewhere else. There's someone more in more need, right? Now, when that is the mentality, like it was 5 years ago and like it is today, wind the clock forward and we have a major issue like COVID that hits everyone sort of all at once. But all young people have their own individual issues that hit them pretty substantially along those journeys. We have not equipped young people with the social and emotional resilience skills required to deal with these scenarios. So a lack of investment 5 years ago from government, from high net wealth, from anyone giving $50 to any charity anywhere, a lack of focus on preventative measures 5 years ago has meant that a whole bunch of young people today really struggle to deal with the situation they're in.
So basically, the majority of funding, the majority of effort's gone into reaction and bugger all into preventative.
Mate, if I sit with anybody, right, and I have a conversation with them about, what's the only long-term solution to mental health, 100% of the time they agree that it's preventative measures, educate people, that's the only long-term solution. But when it comes time to actually write a check, and I don't care whether you're writing a $1 billion check and you're the government or you're writing a $10 check and you're just an average person or anywhere in between, you're a corporate aligning itself to a charity, there is significantly less immediate value on the preventative solution than there is on the reactive solution. And so always, 98% of the time, money goes into the reactive solution because it gives an immediate return. We just got to change our view. You know, society needs to change its position, needs to have better conversations around the dinner table. It needs to have better conversations around work. ESG strategies that are in every major corporate in the country now, they need to change their position and say, actually, of course we need to continue to provide money for intervention work. But we need to really ramp up the focus on preventative work and from a mental health perspective and what we do, create an environment where young people can develop better mental strength so they can make better decisions in their life moving forward.
Well, the passion is pretty obvious. Fergus, thanks so much for joining us today. Disappointment, it's a big part of life, but so is resilience. You experienced that first. And you've definitely shown the ladder. What you've gone to do is quite amazing, and clearly you've got a lot to be proud of. Well done on all you've achieved. I feel like you're only just starting at 36 years of age. Thanks for joining us, and best of luck with everything in the future.
Good on you, mate. Thank you.
And thank you for joining us also. You've been listening to This Is Your Journey for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. Jump online to find tobinbrothers.com.au. We'll catch you the next time we celebrate another great sporting journey.